You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. One of the incredible paradoxes of our moment is that Donald Trump has maintained shockingly high approval ratings through the worst political scandal since Watergate. And he has largely done this by railing against elites in politics, in the media, and in government. And never mind the fact that he holds the highest political office in the country, got there by virtue of the attention lavished on him by media, and is the actual head of the government that he so frequently rails against. If there is a name for the type of politics he practices, that name is populism. And our next guest has just written a book about it. Barry Eichengreen is professor of economics and political science at UC Berkeley. His latest book, The Populist Temptation, Economic Grievance and Political Reaction in the Modern Era. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Brian.
You start with a working definition for us. How are you defining populism?
I define populism as a political movement or tendency with three elements: anti-elite, as you emphasized a moment ago, anti-other or nativist, anti-immigrant, in other words, and third, a movement with authoritarian tendencies. So I think we've seen these kind of movements throughout history where politicians display all three elements. There are, though, populist movements of the left, which emphasize the anti-elite element typically, and populist movements of the right, which emphasize the anti-immigrant or anti-other.
And so the populism of the left would aspire to use the authority of the state against the power of elites, and of the right to deploy the authority of the state against the other, however that's defined.
Yes. So populism, the populist revolt in the United States in the late 19th century, which culminated in the unsuccessful presidential campaign of William Jennings Bryan, who was the candidate of the Democratic Party, but also of the Populist or People's Party, was a campaign of the people against the bankers, against the railroad barons, and against powerful politicians who didn't accommodate or speak to the needs of the common people.
You actually start the clock in your history of populism earlier than that, with the Luddites in England.
And the Luddites, in some sense, were a populist movement as well. I think of populism as being motivated by a combination of economic grievances and identity concerns or identity politics. The economic grievances can be real or imagined, but they revolve around stagnant incomes. They revolve around a sense of inequality. And I think they revolve around, above all, a sense of economic insecurity. So the Luddites, the handloom weavers in England, primarily in Southeast England in the early 19th century, were reacting against mechanization and the insecurity they felt about their future economic prospects.
Right. Luddites become a shorthand for someone who's opposed to new technology. But the account you give is people who both face the prospect of losing their livelihoods and also see the economy becoming much more productive, but all the gains from that productivity going to landlords and early capitalists, the owners of those machines. That's a fairly sophisticated political analysis compared to how we think of Luddites today.
The Luddites were concerned about what they saw as a growing economy where the gains were accruing to others rather than themselves. There was also at the same time in England the so-called swing riots where small farmers, farm laborers were reacting against the sense that they were losing control over their lives, and in a growing economy, the gains were accruing to others, to large, powerful landlords. Again, I think in the United States at the end of the 19th century, farmers were generally doing okay in the Midwest of the United States, but they saw others doing even better. And they perceived a loss of control over their own fate. So the populist movement in the late 19th century was partly a reaction to high mortgage interest rates and high railroad freight rates that the farmers thought were unfair, that were, it was partly a reaction against the rise of powerful railroad barons and oil magnates like John D. Rockefeller. But it was also a reaction against the commercialization of the economy and the sense on the part of farmers and others that they were no longer in control of their own fate. So I think that is a recurrent theme motivating dissatisfaction with the prevailing political system and with conventional political leaders, that they're not speaking to the economic grievances of the people, but more broadly, that the people are losing control of their own fate. And I think we saw very much the same emotional reaction and political tendency on the part of many of Donald Trump's voters in 2016 and in the Brexit debate in the UK.
Well, let's pick up with the 21st century in a moment. Before we do, I'd like to stay in the 19th century. You ask two recurrent questions with every populist movement that you chronicle in this book. First is, what are the economic conditions that give rise to this movement? And the second is, why did it succeed or fail? So let's start with the Luddites and the populist movement that gave rise to William Jennings Bryan's run at the presidency. Neither of those were successful on their own terms. Why not?
Partly the answer is good luck, that if the economy as a whole begins to do better, it will lift almost all boats. So the British economy began to do better after the 1810s and 1820s. In the United States at the end of the 19th century, there had been a big financial crisis at the beginning of the 1890s, but the economy came out of that, where prices had been falling, and that had been making life tough for the farmers in the United States. There were gold discoveries in the Klondike and Western Australia.
We need to back up and explain that. So there was economic crashes caused by deflationary cycles because the U.S. was on the gold standard. This was one of the principal grievances of farmers who advocated for moving to a silver standard to increase the supply of money. Suddenly there was more gold in the world.
Very well put. So the fortuitous fact, the good luck that there was more gold in the world, began to push up prices. The best book, actually, best recent book on the 1896 election between the populist William Jennings Bryan and the Republican candidate who proved triumphant, William McKinley, was written by none other than Karl Rove, the conservative advisor to Bush too. And Rove credits the fact that the economy began to do better for purely fortuitous reasons for McKinley's victory. So part of the answer is a better performing economy, whether because of good luck or good policies. Part of the answer to whether populist movements fail or succeed is whether the political class does attempt to respond to the perceived grievances of the people. So there were political reforms in Britain starting in the 1830s that did enfranchise, give the vote to more individuals. At the end of the 19th century in the United States, there was the progressive movement that, among other things, established the Interstate Commerce Commission to deal with railroad freight rates and the perceived abuses there. If we go to the 20th century, there was a populist upsurge in the United States in the 1930s. Huey Long was preparing to run for the presidency in 1936. But the fact that the economy began to do better, plus the fact that there was successful effort on the part of the political mainstream in the form of the New Deal to deal with perceived economic insecurity. In response to the problem of insecurity, we got the social security. Right. So whether there is a response on the part of the political mainstream matters importantly as well.
certainly most historians would count Franklin Delano Roosevelt the single most successful progressive reformer of American history. He did battle with his share of elites, both rhetorically and in the realm of politics, but you do not count him among the ranks of history's populists. Why not? Where do you draw the distinction?
It's hard to think about FDR as a populist. He was certainly a member of the elite coming from Groton.
Fair enough. So is Donald Trump.
Harvard. And from that point of view, I think we have to hesitate before we label Donald Trump a true populist. Is he a true populist, or is he a member of the elite who hangs around with other members of the elite and favors policies that benefit the elite while casting himself as a populist? So I think there is a real question there, but the classic factors, both economic insecurity and identity politics, that breed support for populist politicians certainly bred support for Trump.
So the explanation of Trump's rise to power is still contested terrain for political scientists. And there was an initial hot take that circulated in the media that this was a working class or white working class revolt against political elites. But there's a counter narrative that is fairly well substantiated by the data on who voted how, that racial animus and racial backlash, independent of class identity and class politics, has more explanatory power, that this was a nation with a long and racist history reacting to 8 years of having a black man in the White House.
I'm very strongly of the view that it's not one or the other. If you can be eclectic and strongly of a view at the same time, that this combination of economic grievance and economic insecurity on the one hand with anti-other animosity on the other was what came together and resulted in Trump's election. So different groups define the other in different ways, but if it's predominantly the white working class and middle class that voted for Trump, somewhat less educated than average, white middle class and working class, to some extent they defined the other as racial minorities, religious minorities. To some extent, they defined the other as foreigners. It was the same people, after all, less educated than average, middle class and working class white voters who felt that economic insecurity. And at the same time, they felt their identity as the dominant group within American society who defined the country's values as under threat by racial, religious, and ethnic minorities.
Let's drill down on the question of economic insecurity, because it's not intuitive. When Donald Trump won election in 2016, it was after 7 years of continual economic growth, dropping unemployment, and at the beginning of an inflection point that saw an increase in real inflation-adjusted wages for the American public. This is not a demagogue running for office in the middle of the Great Depression.
That's exactly right. And that's one of the challenges for people like me who want to argue that economic insecurity played an important role. So I would say two things about your observation. Number one, real wages had stagnated for the average worker, not since the global financial crisis only, but for decades. There was the sense that people were not keeping up. And looking forward, the insecurity reflected the perception on the part of parents that their children were not going to be able to achieve the lifestyle that the parents had themselves achieved, owing to changes in the economy. Part of the problem, I think, is the difficulty people have about identifying those changes in the economy and their source. The evidence is strong that the increase in inequality and the stagnation of working class wages reflected primarily the effect of technology. that favored skilled workers and disfavored less skilled workers, and only secondarily import competition. It was mainly robots and not China. But Trump was able to play bait and switch, and he was right to recognize that even if the economy was growing, not everyone was benefiting.
He also recognized that there was an elite consensus in American politics in support of advancing free trade deals, often negotiated under circumstances that were completely opaque to the American public, and that nobody with a bully pulpit in American politics was speaking to the downside of those deals.
That's right. The economics profession, of which I'm a card-carrying member, bears blame here. One of the first things we teach our students when we talk about trade deals is that even if the country as a whole benefits, every group need not benefit. That point we were just talking about, and I think to a considerable extent, the experts forgot that important point, and Trump was able to discredit NAFTA and the World Trade Organization and the entire global trading regime, in a sense, by emphasizing that valid point at the expense of everything else.
Speaking of Barry Eichengreen, he's a professor of economics and political science at UC Berkeley. His latest book, The Populist Temptation, Economic Grievance and Political Reaction in the Modern Era. So let me ask you to draw another comparison. A large part of this book dwells on those figures who successfully reformed their governments to blunt populist movements. Otto von Bismarck in Germany, who created the first modern welfare state. Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the midst of the Great Depression. The first president that our 21st century Great Recession ushered into office was Barack Obama. He came in promising to be a reformer, but he did not produce the kind of redistributive reforms that you saw under a Franklin Delano Roosevelt or an Otto von Bismarck or the other examples you have in the book. Do you think that failure of the Obama administration is what made Trump possible?
Yes, I think if Obama had been able to do more in terms of reforming the financial system, he did, after all, put Obamacare in place, which was an important achievement that, despite the best efforts of the Congress and Obama's successor, has not been dismantled.
But rather than blunting populism, that was the fertile ground out of which rose the Tea Party movement, which flipped control of Congress less than a year after the passage of Obamacare.
Still, I think as people learn about Obamacare, they are become supporters. Obama's failure to do more reflected two things. Number one, that we were able to stabilize the economy more effectively than we had been in the 1930s. So the urgency of root and branch reform was perceived as less. And number two, we quickly got divided government again after 2009.
So this is your third diagnostic criterion for circumstances under which populist movements prevail, and that is when the apparatus of policymaking is inflexible in the face of rising populist movements, when you don't have an FDR or an Otto von Bismarck able to radically reform the government, then the regime is apt to be overturned.
That's right, and it's partly a matter of whether that key political leader appears on the scene or not. And it's partly a matter of what kind of political institutions a country has. So one of the questions I ask in the book is whether the United States or Europe is more at risk of populism. My conclusion is that for a variety of reasons, European political institutions, the way leaders are selected, the way elections are conducted, those institutions are more robust and more resilient to capture by populist outsiders than our institutions in the United States, where it's possible for a political candidate like Trump, very much out of the party mainstream, without support from Republican Party leaders, to capture the nomination. And because of the particular electoral institutions we have in the United States, with crazy congressional districts and an electoral college that overrepresents rural voters, it was possible for him to capture the general election as well with a minority of the popular vote.
So you're speaking about two different features of American democracy. One is that our political parties are relatively incoherent and not subject to central control compared to political parties in a parliamentary democracy like you have in Europe. The other is that our system of representation, our formal system for choosing who is in the government, was designed to reflect a status quo that was minority rule in 18th century America. The franchise was limited to white landowning men.
That's right. And that's where the Electoral College comes from, absolutely. I think more generally, I worry about the ability of the American political system, but American society more generally, to meet this populist challenge. Because of that history, Americans have a deep and abiding suspicion, many Americans have a deep and abiding suspicion of government, of central government, of the federal government. And that suspicion, whether they understand it or not, is in good part a legacy of slavery and the Reconstruction period after the Civil War, where Southern states wanted to limit the interference of the federal government in local labor relations and in how the Southern economy was organized. FDR, who we were talking about a moment ago, did achieve a lot with the New Deal, but many New Deal programs had to be administered by the states in order for him to get them passed through the Congress, which enabled Southern politicians to administer unemployment insurance and other programs in ways that benefited certain groups and disfavored others.
Barry Eichengreen, before we close, I wanted to kind of ask you about your position writing this book. This is a book about movements that arise to challenge elites, and you teach political science and economics at one of the most elite universities in the country. You are contributing to the political formation of people who will go on to run our government and our largest businesses. You're not exactly making your argument about populism from neutral ground, are you?
Well, I am making it from UC Berkeley, which you described as an elite institution, but we also have more first-generation American students and Pell Grant recipients than the entire Ivy League. I think, as I said before, the elites bear responsibility for the circumstances that led up to the global financial crisis, for our failure to deal with it better, and for the populist reaction that those failures elicited. Part of the problem was the failure of the elites to communicate what we knew to voters, to the people, in plain English.
Yeah. So I guess that circles back to an earlier question I had. The implication is people don't actually know what they want. But isn't it plausible that for the vast majority of Trump's base, they were not voting for an economic program? They were voting because they wanted a loudmouth, destructive, xenophobic racist in office to reflect their own animus back at them?
It's hard to dispute that characterization, but I do think that a better performing economy, better economic policies, compensation for the people left behind by technical change and import competition would have limited that sense of anger toward the political mainstream, toward the parties, toward the elites. And patient voters would have presumably voted for a more patient presidential candidate. Mm.
Sounds like a lovely world to live in. Barry Eichengreen, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Barry Eichengreen is a professor of economics and political science at UC Berkeley. His latest book, The Populist Temptation, Economic Grievance and Political Reaction in the Modern Era.